Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, Alan Epstein representing Spring Park Meadows Association. With me at counsel table is Christopher Bryant. Spring Park will rest on the briefs respecting the procedural lack of findings and conclusions in support of the trial court's order of preliminary injunction, unless the court has questions, and instead go directly to the substantive issue. The basis of the trial court's ruling.
Pardon me, Mr. Epstein, I do have a question. I apologize. One of my concerns here is that because there was a preliminary injunction granted, we only have the trial court in the transcript talking about one of the six rescue factors, and that's the reasonable likelihood of success on the merits. What are we supposed to do with that?
If the trial court was incorrect on that prong of the test, then the remedy is, I suppose, to address, the court would address that issue and remand to consider the other prongs of the test, except for the fact that if the trial court was wrong with respect to that issue, as a procedural matter, I think Spring Park would win. So if you address the likelihood of success on the merits, I'm not sure that the other prongs or the other elements of the test would need to be addressed, because if the court was wrong about the interpretation of Kiowa in connection with the water regulations and the declaration, then I think Spring Park wins. And the correct ruling as a matter of law is that Spring Park is entitled to continue termination of the water service.
But hypothetically, if we were to say that the court was right about that, we've still got five of the factors that there's no analysis on.
Yes, and if that's the case, then I think you must remand for the trial court to address those issues, those separate problems of the test.
Doesn't that suggest that this is up here prematurely?
Possibly. That was why we raised the issue.
Thank you.
Following up on Judge Bernard's question, Mr. Epstein, as I read the briefs, it occurred to me that the parties really don't have a dispute over the factors, the Rafke factors. Their dispute is the interpretation of the contract. And so, regardless how you come out on the interpretation, perhaps you don't have to send it back if the parties concede that, assuming that interpretation of the contract is one way, those factors are met.
Yes, if the trial court was correct, that was my first point, then it needs to be no further inquiry. If the trial court was wrong, then I think Judge Bernard's suggestion was it has to go back for further findings with respect to the other five elements. So I agree. If the trial court was incorrect, Spring Park wins. I think is the correct analysis.
I want to be sure I understand. You're saying that if this court were to find that the trial court was correct in its analysis of the likelihood of success factor, that you concede the other factors?
No, I don't think we do concede the other factors. I think that's what that would have to be determined on remand. But if the trial court is incorrect, then Spring Park prevails as a matter of law.
I understand your position. Thank you.
The basis of the trial court's ruling granting Venture's preliminary injunction was its reasoning that the association had no right to condition resumption of water service on Venture's payment of the water arrearages incurred by Venture's predecessor in interest, the Russells, after the bank foreclosed on the property and the association exercised its super priority lien under CRS 3833.3316. As a matter of law, the association submits this reasoning was incorrect. Section 316 gives a super priority lien for 6 months of unpaid charges and assessments, and it provides that an association's foreclosure of its lien extinguishes the lien, but Kiowa says nothing about whether extinguishment of the lien extinguishes the underlying debt in excess of that lien, amount. And importantly, it does not preclude homeowners and HOAs to undertake contractual rights and obligations that do not directly conflict with the statute's provisions. In fact, Kiowa does contemplate contractual modification of its provisions. For example, Section 316, Subsection 1, provides that unless the declaration otherwise provides, fees, charges, etc., are enforceable as assessments under this article. So, Section 316 gives an association special lien rights, but it does not, contrary to Venture's argument, extinguish the underlying debt in excess of the 6 months priority lien.
Counsel, I'm not understanding how you get from the Russell's debt, which is not extinguished. How does that become the debt of those subsequent owners?
Because
you argue that it does.
We are arguing that it does. By virtue of three declaration and water service regulation provisions. Water service regulation 10.2 provided that non-payment of water bills permitted the association to shut off water service to the lot until the violation was cured to the satisfaction of the association or until any past due fees, charges, fines, penalties, costs, or other amounts due or recoverable by the association are paid in full. Article 28, Section 18.11 of the Declaration provided that the provisions hereof shall run with the land and be binding on all persons who hereafter become the owner of any interest in the real estate. And most importantly, Section 8.6 of the Declaration provided, quote, the amount of any annual and special assessment and charges payable with respect to an owner or an owner's lot shall be a personal obligation of the owner and such owner's heirs, devisees, personal representatives, successors, and assigns. Ventures is the prior owner's successor. Our argument is that read together, these provisions unambiguously notify a property owner's successor in interest that a prior owner's past debt, past due unpaid charges become their obligation.
Counsel, the previous section in the declaration is 8.5 that deals with charges doesn't make any reference to water and refers back to penalties for violations. How do you read that section to include a debt for attorney fees related to a water bill as a charge?
Attorney fees related to a water bill?
Well, isn't that what you're attempting to collect from these owners?
The initial charge we're attempting to collect is the past due arrearage, not the attorney's fees. I think the attorney's fees is a separate analysis that comes later. We're not arguing about attorney fees at this point in the litigation, but the arrearages that were owed by the Russells under these three provisions, we argue, clearly does become the obligation of Ventures. The water assessment is an assessment. The New Jersey Supreme Court's Highland Lakes decision addressed a virtually identical factual scenario. Ventures argues it was the only case the association could find to support its argument, and it was, but Ventures found no case to support its argument. The cases on which Ventures relies predate the advent of homeowners associations and hold that a water utility cannot, in the absence of a lien or contract, hold a subsequent owner liable for a prior tenant's water service obligation. But here there is a contract. And Ventures argues that public policy considerations favor a rule precluding enforcement of past due water charges on subsequent purchasers. On the contrary, public policy favors homeowners associations acting in the interest of association members as a whole when one delinquent owner saddles the other owners with their debt. Ventures bought this property with notice that the declaration and water regulations allowed the association to enforce its provisions on subsequent owners. Ventures purchased the property with actual notice of the water arrears debt of its predecessor in interest, and it purchased the property with actual notice that the water service had been terminated because of the delinquent water charges.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Epstein, but I want to go back to your discussion of the various provisions in the declaration. Would you please address your opponent's argument concerning the specific phrase such owner, and his argument that the phrase such owner means the person who owned the place at the time that the debt was originally incurred?
Well, I think that grammatical argument fails in light of section 8.6 of the declaration. It could be read that way. Such owner could be read as that the only owner, not a subsequent owner, or it could mean any owner. But in light of section 8.6, which provided that an owner, not such owner, or such owner's lot shall be a personal obligation of the owner and such owner's heirs, devisees, successors, and assigns. Such owner's successor clearly and unambiguously means a predecessor in interest, or a successor in interest, rather. That's our argument. That's why we think the grammatical argument fails.
Is it enough, though, to suggest that there's ambiguity in this declaration?
No, I'm not suggesting that there's ambiguity.
I know you're not. I'm asking, is this conflict between such owner and an owner dash 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 successor enough to suggest that there's ambiguity?
I don't believe that it is ambiguous. I think that those three sections together, read together, particularly section 8.6, is unambiguous. And we understand the court must anticipate the presidential impact of this decision beyond the specific facts of this case, but the facts of this case are pretty compelling. And Venture's argument that holding it responsible for water service arrearages would be unfair in this case is hypocritical. Ventures bought a $4 million property for $2 million, knowing there was a relatively small debt that it was also buying in order to return water service to the property. What is unfair is to hold the other innocent HOA members liable for the debt Venture's predecessor in interest. Trump's policy favors permitting homeowners associations to enforce its declarations and regulations to advance the welfare of its members as a whole by requiring each unit of the association to pay its own fair share of common property maintenance. We ask that the court reverse and remand with directions for further proceedings in accordance with the ruling that section 10.2 of the water service regulations is enforceable against Ventures. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Epstein. Thomas.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Peter Thomas, appearing here on behalf of the plaintiff, Spring Park Ventures. The simple question before the court today is whether a property after foreclosure can still be burdened by some sort of inchoate financial liability that survives the provisions of 38-38-501 and 38-33.3-316.
Mr. Thomas, I'd like to, if I may, ask a question that we posed to Mr. Epstein. Our standard of review here is de novo, isn't it?
It is, yes, Your Honor.
And in light of that, we're called upon to interpret contractual language. Aren't we able to look at the record and determine whether the facts of the record support the Rathke factors?
We believe that the five Rathke factors that, as Judge Bernard pointed out, were not addressed by the trial court are self-evident and necessarily flow from the conclusion that the trial court reached with regard to the first one being the likelihood of success. although we would submit that the case is not up here prematurely, I think we're all aware that we got here through somewhat circuitous procedural process, attempting to have this the question of law on the first Ratke factor certified under 4.2, and then we ended up coming back under Rule 4 instead. So the court could certainly remand back to the trial court for further factual findings on those five elements. But let's not forget that the parties did stipulate to all the facts. The parties stipulated to the admission of all the exhibits. We had oral argument. A minute order was issued. The association turned down the trial court's invitation for a full evidentiary hearing. And so there are other factors as to why the full Ratke analysis is not done.
Thank you.
I have another procedural question for you. This comes to us to review the grant of a preliminary injunction. We don't have a finding of what the actual interpretation of these declarations are. All we have is a finding that there's a likelihood of success in your client. Can we do anything other than saying we affirm or we overrule that finding? How can we make a finding of what these declarations mean when there's never been such a finding in the trial court?
Your Honor, I don't think it's necessary to even get to the declaration in the first instance, because the association's argument cannot be considered without giving some focus to the foreclosure statute in Kiowa, because we have to give intent to the legislature, the statutory constraints that are imposed on homeowner associations when a property goes through foreclosure, essentially washed in a washing machine and comes out clean on the backside of it. And even if we do then shift to the declaration, we believe that our textual and grammatical interpretation of the declaration provides a more harmonious reading of all the provisions, whereas the association has continued to try to winnow this court's view down to some very narrow issues. Even here this morning, they are now taking the position that 8.6 trumps everything. Well, we don't have any problem with Section 8.6 of the Declaration. 8.6, if we divorce it from the context of a foreclosure, such as what we're addressing here, provides some additional and adequate assurances to the association that, as a practical matter, aren't typically going to be necessary anyway, because if I was going to buy Mr. Epstein's condominium, we'd have a contract that would presumably ensure that he's giving it to me free and clear. We'd go through title insurance, and the title insurance company, as a matter of course, would prorate taxes, utilities, and association dues, net them out of the sale proceeds, and make sure all that's paid.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Thomas, but I would like to take another step based on Judge Nieto's question. Don't we have to look at the declaration here because of Mr. Epstein's argument that the declaration unambiguously says that when your client entered bought this property, it basically entered into a contract. And according to Mr. Epstein's argument, I understand you disagree with it, but according to Mr. Epstein's argument, that contract says you owe this money.
We don't disagree that a declaration runs with the land, that it constitutes a contract between a homeowners association and an owner. The problem, however, is that we're not just talking about a contractual issue here. We're talking about, I mean, even if we look at the Highland Lakes case that they're relying on, the court in that case references an equitable lien and explains the equitable lien as something that quotes specific property to which the debt attaches, and an intent expressed or implied that the property will serve as security for payment of the debt. Well, that's an encumbrance by any definition. And encumbrances are eliminated through foreclosure. So again, we have to come back and look at the process through Kiowa and the Foreclosure Act to see that what they're really trying to do here through contract has the net effect of imposing a financial burden on property that should not be on that property after foreclosure. As to the declaration itself, though, Section 8.6 that they're relying on for the language of successors, which they say unambiguously defines successors. Well, again, you can't read that in isolation without looking at all the modifying and limiting language in the declaration. For example, 8.6 is expressly subordinate to Section 8.7. 8.7, to paraphrase, says that 8.6 doesn't apply in the event of a foreclosure. 8.7 says two things. 8.7 says that in the event of a transfer of a lot in a foreclosure, one, all of the assessment liens in excess of what we're entitled to by super priority rights in Kyle are extinguished. And two, the lien holder, in this case being U.S. Bank, does not become personally liable for the debt of its predecessor. It says that right here. So, what do you do with that? Well, you have to look at standard analysis of vertical privity from X to Y to Z. And here, what we've got is a bank intervening in the middle of a foreclosure process. And the association has never addressed the question of how the debt by Russell can, under 8.7, they have to acknowledge that it doesn't go to the bank, and the bank's not personally liable for it. So the association is apparently saying that it just hopscotches over like over the bank like some checkerboard game, and that other successors become responsible for that. Well, that's not at all what Section 8.6 says. And to the extent that that's an interpretation of it, we would submit that the document is ambiguous and should be construed against the drafter. As far as the applicable argument that's being made by the association, we also shouldn't lose sight of the fact that associations aren't without other recourse here. They have the super priority lien, which is what our General Assembly decided was the appropriate amount to give them by striking a balance between the need to ensure associations get some reasonable amount of dues and also ensuring that transferees subject to a post-foreclosure are taking title free and clear of any liens or encumbrances, or in this case, which is kind of, I don't know what they're trying to call it, but it is the effect of an encumbrance on this property. Two, they had a right of redemption. To the extent they had a remaining amount left, they could have stepped in and exercised that right of redemption and bought the property themselves. And if, as they say, there's so much equity in the property that we got such a great deal, well, they could have bought the property, turned around and flipped it, and recovered the purchase price and all the past due monies that they claimed were owed, and probably made a tiny profit to boot. Third, they filed a lawsuit in the Eagle District Court against Russell. Go collect it. They've still got that option. And fourth, in this particular situation, they're acting as a water service provider, but they did not form a special district. Had they formed a special district to provide water, they would have been clothed with additional statutory protections that our legislature deemed to be appropriate. And special district assessments are treated somewhat akin to taxes, where they are senior to the foreclosing lien and they survive foreclosure. Contrary to the association's argument, though, the list of some of the older cases that we pointed to showing the long-standing history throughout the country of not allowing water service providers to terminate essential utilities to try to extort money out of successors, those cases don't stand for the proposition, but if you just enter a contract that says you can do that, then therefore it's valid. It's not at all what they say. All those cases say is that if there is either a statute, or if there's a municipal ordinance that is appropriately enacted pursuant to a statute, or if there's a contract that is enacted pursuant to legislative authority in law that's been granted to them. So they have none of that here. But they've just gone and tried to devise a way for themselves to try to get around the six-month cap, saying, no, look, we don't like the six-month cap that legislature's imposed. We want more. So we're going to find a way to go get it in some other way. My time's starting to run out, and I want to make sure I have a chance to address all the questions from the court here. In that case, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Mr. Bryan, I understand you're going to be giving rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I understand I have a couple of minutes. I'd like to just address some key facts. Christopher D. Bryan, Attorney Registration Number 35522. Your Honor, there's one issue that Mr. Thomas brought up that I think really requires this court to give the textual attention it deserves. He's relying very heavily on Section 8.7 of the Declaration, and if you read that, the term that shall extinguish the lien, it doesn't say it'll extinguish the debt. It says extinguish the lien. So to the extent that he's relying on that to trump 8.6, then he's misreading the Declaration, and that's important for this court. This HOA planned this for exactly this purpose, so that if a wife owns a property, runs up a debt, she can't just deed it to her husband and ergo extinguish the debt. The idea is if you choose to voluntarily take title to a property that has debt on it, you're right. Your statutory lien rights may be extinguished per Kiowa and per the Declaration, but the underlying debt that lien secures may remain. So,
Counsel, I'm still not seeing how you get the Russell's debt to jump over the bank and become the third owner's debt.
It doesn't jump over the bank, Your Honor.
Well, the bank doesn't owe it.
Well, Your Honor, we had the water terminated during the bank's ownership for 8 months or so, and we had these same arguments. And they didn't bring a declaratory action to say that we have to pay the debt. The water service was terminated. It remained terminated when Ventures took title. So the water termination was the actual remedy. And the bank could have brought a lawsuit to declare that. The Ventures could have negotiated for indemnity on that issue. They did not. They got a $2 million price concession, which presumably built that into it. But they took title with water turned off, knowing water was turned off, and with negotiations about that. I see that my time's expired.
Thank you, Mr. Bryan.
Thank you.
Thanks again to counsel for your arguments today. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.